to go closer to my community, and made a few calls, and there we were. And it was a space that was not, you know, they're terribly expensive spaces, but they're also spaces.
Concerned about what's happening in Guyana. It continues to increase, continues to be an area of focus, and we feel that enough is not being done to address it. So we're trying to sensitize our Guyanese, those of us in the diaspora, are getting together to talk about these issues. We're going to look to see generally what this whole concept of domestic violence is, how it impacts our children, how it's dealing within the community, the religious community. We're going to look at that a little, because religion and our lifestyle has a lot to do with how we function. We're also going to have someone who works in child welfare, and we ourselves know how it's impacting the families and the children. So we're going to have some discussion in that, as well as we're going to talk about suicide. We have an expertise, someone who's fully aware of the whole concept of suicide. So as we, the professionals, bring into play what these issues are, we're going to try to relate it to Guyana, what's happening with our brothers and sisters. And as you know, many of us have either been directly or indirectly impacted by relationship issues, the whole concept of domestic violence. And that's why, for me, it's so important that we could just, this is like a pink elephant in the room for us. Then we get around. What happens in the family stays in the family. We have to go beyond that. And I'm grateful to these gentlemen to really be at the side of us as we're going to be doing this forum next week, Saturday. I would really like to see a lot of people come out. We're not talking about our lifestyle. We're talking about how we can help to minimize, how we can help to reduce this, and how we could address it. Our counterparts in Guyana are working on this issue. So we're going to try to check in to see how they are doing and how we can support them, how they're working, as well as the policy. So is that what I shared with you? Is that useful?
Yeah, thank you very much, Mr. Griffith. Derek Arjun, on this broadcast of Caribbean Forum, several times I have broadcast the documentary Stop the Violence, Break the Silence, which was narrated by my colleague Margaret Lawrence in Guyana. Is this situation out of control?
It certainly is. Guyana has perhaps the highest incidence of domestic violence in the Caribbean. Certainly the highest suicide rate per capita in the world. And that is a horrible statistic. And I mention suicide because domestic violence has a relationship to suicide because of the hopelessness and the beaten down nature that victims tend to feel. They resort to ending their lives. In Guyana, there, like other parts of the Caribbean, you know, there's this idea that women are chattel and also do not enjoy the rights that men do. So that compounds the problem of dealing with domestic violence. When reported, very often it's treated with ridicule and disdain. And indeed, the very people receiving the reports, which happen to be too often men like us, we ourselves are sometimes have been involved or know persons who are involved, and so we're not as sensitive as we ought to be. And the result is that we have this growing occurrence of domestic violence within the country. The judicial system is not responding because that too reflects the attitude of the country that women do not deserve the protection from this activity as they ought to. So it is out of control, and we're hoping that this forum brings to light to Guyanese here, others here, and Guyana, that something has to be done, and done very quickly.
But also, Mr. Arjun, Also, Mr. Arjun, I'm sorry to cut you off, sir, but there's also an unusual high percentage of men who have been abused by women.
Yes, yes, no question about that. And, you know, in forming and putting together this forum, that topic came up. It is not that men aren't abused, and very often men are abused and don't report it. So we tend to, we will address that. The fact of the matter, though, is that most victims of domestic violence are our sisters.
Yes.
Therefore, that's why we actually call this a women's forum, because we recognize most of the victims are women.
Right.
And we wanted the women to lead the discussion. It's not to say that we will not address the
Gentlemen, I'm going to leave you now, okay?
Okay, thank you very much, Ms. Griffith.
Okay, thank you very much for the opportunity to share
about
this program. And I'll see you all next week, Saturday. Be blessed.
Yes, go ahead, Mr. Arjun.
Your point is noted. Your point is noted that men are victims. Unfortunately, we have a different attitude when men report domestic violence, and that is, there's laughter. I mean, why can't you handle a woman?
Right.
And so, you know, that points up an unhealthy attitude towards the way we view relationships. You know, the men are the dominant ones, and the women are the servile ones. So we also have to examine the way we look at the sexes within the relationship. And that, too, will come up at the forum, and hopefully it will enlighten both men and women as to how better to treat each other in relationships.
Tony Jones, Mr. Arjun just laid out a statistic there that Guyana is ranked a fourth in suicides per capita worldwide. And it also has the highest rate amongst South American and Caribbean nations. About 40% of people who commit suicide in Guyana poison themselves by consuming agricultural pesticides. Are we witnessing an appendage of the horrific mass suicides that were promulgated by Jim Jones in the hinterland of Guyana back in 1978?
I would say no. The two are really not it's not really related. However, within the context of family violence, domestic violence, and suicide as it applies to Guyana, we are witnessing some new dimensions. One, for example, suicide rates among Afro-Guyanese communities have increased dramatically since 2006. And we are looking into a situation in which the family structure of the African descendants is one in which the woman, for the most part, now is becoming the breadwinner. Mm. And the situation seems to be that because the woman is out there working longer hours than at home, nurturing the family, the husband seems to be at a disadvantage, both in terms of his manhood and his role as a father and husband. And therefore, he is, in some ways, we are still looking into the evidence and the statistics. It appears, however, that he, for the most part, is reaching out both in terms of abusive behavior towards his woman, the women folk and the children. And therefore, we're sensing that that is the financial insecurity of the family and the men in generally within the Afro-Guyanese community is giving rise to both lots of family violence and suicides. The other aspect that we're hoping we can explore is what role the religious communities and faith communities can play to alleviate these problems, both domestic violence, family violence, per se, and suicide. Can and should the religious leaders play a more active, progressive role in in sending the right messages from the pulpit and even away from the pulpit to its followers. So these are some of the things that we are hoping that the presenters, or at least one presenter who has a background in religion, would be exploring, so that we can all have a better understanding of what is happening, the magnitude of the problem, and what minimal role each of us can play to bring about the overall reduction of family violence and suicide within Guyana.
Embedded in your newsletter, the suicide acts are among young people and more prevalent among rural East Indians. If this is true, what do you think is attributable to that?
Well, I guess in many ways, the financial insecurity and this whole novel idea today, in which it seems to be that the young people want these quick fix solutions, self-aggrandizement and, self-actualization all within a matter of few years. And no one is taking the time to go through what you and I and others, our age group, would have been doing, which is to go to school, make sure you go to church every Sunday, have a sense of what the social compass would be for you going forward into adulthood. I think the internet probably is creating some conflicting views for our young people, and the whole question of the family structure, because of the infusion and widespread use of drugs, all of those are having quite a lot of sociological negative impact on the society. And what is very appalling, Ron, is that it seems to me that despite the genuine good faith effort of many concerned volunteers working in various levels within organization, it seems to me the political agencies and government institutions per se is not playing the type of major role to combat this problem that we seem to be facing in the country. But we are hoping that this forum, because of the turnout and coverage that we're giving to this issue and problem, that it will begin not only to sensitize our fellow nationals and the citizens in Guyana what is really at stake here, but we can begin to more take control of solving the problem. I think it's a solvable problem. The question is, how can we muster the type of collective action, right, and effort to tackle this problem?
I want to make sure that we have all the information regarding this forum, but Mr. Derek Arjun has a lack of insight into the reasons for the high prevalence of suicide around the country, inhibited efforts to tackle this problem?
Oh, without question. And that's reflective of the general society, that we're not paying attention to problems in the country, and this includes domestic violence, it includes drug use, it includes truancy. So it is a malaise within the country, which starts with the government, that contributes to what is going on. And no doubt, because our country, that is Guyana, continues to suffer from underdevelopment, in which you see unemployment, you see large migration, you see bad schools, you see a high crime rate, and you see a continuing racial divide, people feel as if that there's no hope in the society. Mm. And that hope translates into either leaving or hurting oneself fatally. And, you cannot move a country forward if you don't address social problems.
Absolutely. We're running out of time. Yeah, I'm sorry to interject. We're running out of time, Mr. Arjun, and I want to make sure that you give our listeners detailed information as to this upcoming forum on November 1st.
Well, it will be...
Go ahead, Mr. Jones.
Sorry.
It is going to take place at the New Life Center of Truth. That is 2400 Snyder Avenue, Brooklyn, New York. And we're hoping to start at 12 noon and conclude at 5 p.m. We have our keynote address will be delivered by Guyanese-born Justice Pam Jackman Brown. And many of us are expecting and looking forward to her address. Why? Because she has elevated herself to prominence, and we are hoping that identifying with us on this problem could give a new impetus to those of us who are sitting on the sideline and feel, well, our contribution cannot make a difference. Apart from that, we are hoping to have a panel discussion. Five panelists would look at various aspects of domestic violence, family violence, and suicide. We are also expecting a number of political representatives to drop by to lend support and to share and give us their testimonials or to give us some support in various other forms.
Please give us a possible...
All in all, we are expecting...
Please give us a possible website or telephone number for contact.
Well, for contact, you can contact the coordinator, Ismay, who had to leave us prematurely. Her number is 347-534-6275. Now, in terms
repeat that number,
of
please,
the
sir.
Address, in terms of the website, you can go to https://sites.google.com/site/center/center/social/development.
Thank you very much. Yes, I'm sorry, we are running out of time. Thank you, Tom Jones, Derek Arjun, and Ismay Griffith. I'd also like to thank my previous guest, Izili Danto, and Sister Karen Mafundikwa here on Caribbean Forum. I'm Ron Bob Semple with you. Have yourself a productive day. Greetings and welcome to Caribbean Forum here on the Hulu Radio Network, where we examine issues that affect Caribbean nationals both at home and across the diaspora. I'm Ron Bob Semple here in the Forum. This morning we're looking forward to a rather informative and packed program where we bring you news, views, interviews, thought-provoking discussions, Caribbean theater of the mind, and musical interludes. I've made it clear to you, my listeners, that I will continue to keep the status of our brothers and sisters in Haiti on the front burner here on Caribbean Forum. Well, joining us today will be the award-winning playwright, performance poet, political and social commentator, author, and human rights attorney, Izili Danto, who was born in Port-au-Prince, Haiti. Also on the forum will be Jamaica-born filmmaker Karen Mafundikwa, whose latest project, The Price of Memory, explores the enduring legacy of slavery in Jamaica and the decades-long movement for reparations. Representatives from the Center for Social Justice and Development, Ismay Griffith, Derek Arjun, and Tony Jones, are gearing up for a women's forum in New York, the theme of which is combating the scourge of domestic violence in Guyana. They, too, will be joining us. Well, happy Diwali to all celebrants of the Festival of Lights. So tell someone the Caribbean Forum is on the air for the next 2 hours here on the Uhuru Radio Network, where you can log on 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, for live and recorded programming. You'll be enlightened by programs such as Africa Live, Diasporic Music, a rebroadcast of which you heard prior to Caribbean Forum, Reparations in Action, and Glenn Ford's Black Agenda Report, as well as Golden Sunday Sounds with yours truly on Sunday evenings. Also, please feel free to log on to uhurunews.com or uhururadio.com and click on the donate button to make whatever contribution you deem affordable so you can keep your radio station on the air. We invite all your listeners to support this radio station by becoming sustaining members. As a paying member, you'll receive unlimited download access to more than 150 speeches by Chairman Amalia Shatella, found on the archive section of uhururadio.com. And be sure to join us during our annual telethon on November 15th and 16th. When we'll be looking to you to help us raise much-needed funds so we can bring you truth to power, which you certainly do not and would not get from mainstream media. All other archives of programs heard on the station are freely available for download or to hear through your browser. And for a minimum contribution of $10 per month, you can become a sustaining member and gain access to these speeches spanning four decades of theoretical and practical leadership from the chairman of the African People's Socialist Party. Subscribe today and support the online voice of the International African Revolution. Well, if there's someone you know who does not have access to a computer right now, let them know that they can listen to us on their landline, their iPhone, their iPad, their Android, by dialing 1-425-905-1825. That's 905-425, area code 425-905-1825. Area code 425-905-1825 and follow the prompts. Thank you for tuning in to Caribbean Forum, where we recently lost a music icon from the Caribbean in John Holt, who succumbed to illness in London. He will be our artist in the spotlight on Golden Sunday Sounds tomorrow, October 26th, from 7 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time.
Show will always be home to me. Oh, island in the sun, gave to me by my father's hand. All my days I will sing and praise of your forest waters, your shining sun. As morning gains the evening eye, I lift my heavy load to the sky. Sun comes down with a burning glow, mix my sweat with the earth below. Oh, island in the sun, gave to me by my father's hand. All my days I will sing and praise of your forest waters, your shining. Tra-la-dee, tra-la-dee.
Of the late John Holt here on Caribbean Forum. Well, John Holt will be our artist in the spotlight Sunday evening, October 26th, on Golden Sunday Sounds. 7 until 10 p.m. Eastern Time.
Alicia Prasad, the Uhuru Radio Network has news and culture direct from Africa, the Caribbean, and wherever Africans are working, playing, and fighting to be free. Support Uhuru today.
Tune in to Caribbean Forum, Saturday mornings 9 to 11 a.m. Eastern Time with Ron Bob Semple on the Uhuru Radio Network.
This is Alan Bomar Jones. The Uhuru Radio Network gives a voice to the voiceless and stands for freedom for African people everywhere. Support it with your contribution today.
On November 15th and 16th, Burning Spear Media will hold our annual fundraising radiothon. We are the Burning Spear newspaper, the longest-running African revolutionary journal in continuous publication since the 1960s. We are Uhuru News, the online voice of the International African Revolution. We are Uhuru Radio, bringing you news, music, analysis, and information every week to every corner of the African world.
Your world.
We are your media, telling the truth about your world. The truth you won't get from your local newspaper, the New York Times, the BBC, CNN, or Fox News. We need your support to survive and grow. You don't have to pledge to white agenda media networks that make empty promises to represent your interests. Burning Spear Media is by and for African people, talking about our reality.
Our reality.
Our conditions.
Our conditions.
And our goals for freedom.
Freedom.
And liberation.
Liberation.
Tune in November 15th and 16th for our two-day radiothon, a live online radio and video broadcast with 20 hours of special guests, music, and reports from our community. Liberate your media with your dollars. Tell your friends. Organize a viewing party. Spread the word. Africa is on the rise, and the future is black.
Avant que vous t'ai parti, te promets-moi que vous écris moi. Avant que vous t'ai parti, te promets-moi que vous appelez-moi. Avant que vous t'ai parti, vous te dit que vous appelez tout en vie, moi. Avant que vous t'ai parti, ou te di ou pape j'en m'ébli, yé moi. Mes semaines passées, moi passé ou parle moi. Ou pa kembe promesse que ou te fait moi. Avant que ou te parti. Mes semaines passées, moi passé ou parle moi. Pas qu'un bel promesse que vous t'ai fait moi. Avant que vous t'ai parti, c'est pas ça on t'ai dit. Avant que vous t'ai parti, ou t'ai dit ou papé j'en m'oublie moi. Avant que vous t'ai parti, ou t'ai dit ou papé vini chez moi. Avant que vous t'ai parti, te promets quoi paix toujours les moi. Avant que vous t'ai parti, ou t'ai dit quoi paix tout la vie, ouais moi. Thank you. téléphoné.
Well, welcome back to Caribbean Forum. I'm Ron Bob Semple with you here on the Huru Radio Network. And that was Armstrong Jean, Avant que tu partes. Well, not too often do I have on the program someone who is as well-rounded as my guest I'm about to introduce. She's an award-winning playwright, political and social commentator, author and a human rights attorney, and I'm sure she has a few other attributes up her sleeves. Sister Zili Danto, welcome to Caribbean Forum.
Thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. Ms. Danto, what is it about your childhood growing up in Haiti that has molded you into the person you are today?
I suppose I was raised under Baby Doc Duvalier, where most of the people were not allowed to speak. I was very young when I came to the United States. I was born in Haiti, but raised in the United States. I left Haiti when I was 5. But the, I remember a couple of things about Haiti. I'm not sure that it's not just Haiti. It's the fact that I'm a black woman and I'm living in this hemisphere, in this world, where the black woman's child is constantly being destroyed, the black nations are constantly being destroyed. But as a child, I was raised under Duvalier, and I was taught when I got to college that was because the United States wanted to keep out communism, and as if that was a good reason, a logical reason for the destruction of a whole people and the putting down of dictatorship and terror by the state. So that's what I was raised under, that's what my parents fought. And before them, I come from a nation of people who took out the enslavers for the first time in history. You have a people that were enslaved that took out their enslavers. So I come from that heritage, and I would think that that's that road less traveled.
You have been referred to as the spiritual ambassador to Haiti. Your colonial name was Marguerite Laurent, and you were inspired, guided, and directed by the strength, the legacy, and the visions of the Haitian warrior goddess Zili Danto. What was that transformation like?
It was not a conscious transformation, but it was a thousand ways to be broken. And the path to wholeness. That's what it was. A thousand ways to be broken and the path of rebirth and wholeness.
A thousand ways to be broken. How profound.
Yeah. That's what it was like.
Yes, in about 2.5 months, Ms. Danto, the world will be remembering the devastating earthquake that killed hundreds of thousands of our brothers and sisters on your native land, Haiti. How would you categorize the status of Haiti today?
There's a quiet genocide happening in Haiti, and that the earthquake was part of that genocide. The response to the earthquake is part of the genocide. The consequences of Bill Clinton giving a facelift to the U.S. occupation of Haiti by using the earthquake to show that it was a humanitarian mission, when it is and has always been a mission to bring back the Duvalieres to power. The Duvalieres my parents fought against, and my parents before me fought against. And Duvalieres in Haiti are the colonial Vestavex, the colonial black collaborators who collaborate with injustice, what probably some people would see as the new slave raiders the black slave traders would go in and sell their own to make money and to gain power within the white supremacist world. The earthquake was used by Bill Clinton, Dr. Paul Farmer, the NGO industry, the human rights industry. All of these are levels of what we call Najokis, the evil forces of empire and white supremacy, to continue and to hasten, actually, the selling off and auctioning off of Haiti lands by doing a mock election during the time when people were amputated and you had 320,000 people dead in 33 seconds, something that's never been recorded, really, in human history. And so it was at that point that under Obama, Bill Clinton and Mrs. Clinton, which the Obama administration basically gave Haiti to them to do as they will and to provide the cover for to hasten things that the United States has wanted to do in Haiti for a long time. Haiti is a country rich in resources, a country that rich in strategic location for the power plays of the Western world between Cuba and Venezuela. So the coup d'etat in 2004 was the beginning of the UN occupation of Haiti for on behalf of the UN is a colonial hired guns for the U.S., France, and Canada and white supremacy. And then the earthquake, and before the earthquake, the various climate changes and hurricanes that we had, you know, four back-to-back storms and one in 2008 that drowned out one of our major cities, La Gonaiva, so all of these crises are used to further help white supremacy, whether it's in terms of making buying off our offshore islands, or whether it's keeping the people not participating in the process by putting in people that would never be elected in normal times, like Michel Martelly, who's the current de facto president, or Lamotte, who's the prime minister, who doesn't have residency requirements or whatever to become prime minister. These are the things that the U.S. was able to achieve in Haiti. So we are in a situation right now where even Haitians, before it was Haitians, once the coup d'etat and the regime change were coming into Haiti, Haitians were running away from the political repression or from the economic repression, trying to find life some other place. But even in Haiti right now, we have more white folks and northerners buying land and living behind gates. They just come in on with Bill Gates and Clinton, and all these guys are buying Haitian lands. But what's critically important, for instance, is on the island of Isla Vache, where the people have lived for over 200 years. It's an island that's in the south of Haiti, north of Venezuela. You have what the task of Bill Clinton, the neoliberals, disaster capitalism, unfettered capitalism, unregulated capitalism, folks, is to come in and do three things in Haiti. What the new colonialism or the how colonialism is implemented in these days is to, you know, our labor, of course, is sweatshop slavery. Our resources are theirs for them to do as they wish once they put in a government that they can control. Then they make laws under Clinton, just like under FDR back in during the first U.S. occupation of Haiti from 1915 to 1934. They changed our Haitian constitution under Clinton from the earthquake in 2010. So now they've been changing our Haitian constitution to allow for things that the Haitian constitution protected with regards to our mines, our coastal lands, and so forth. So, for instance, in Isla Vache, this island that is right off of the southern tip of Haiti, there's 20,000 Haitians living in the island. They are being taken off or pushed off or taken so that tourist havens could be made for white tourists to come in while Haitians are being made homeless. So that's really what's going on. And $10 billion was raised in the UN by the World Bank supervised by Bill Clinton. And according to the New York Times, it's left little footprint in Haiti. Some of the biggest things that's been achieved with that $10 billion that they collected in the name of helping Haitians is four-star hotels like the Oasis, expanding the airport for more tourists and white people to come in. Most of the 1.7 million Haitians on the streets homeless in 2010. So as we're heading towards the fifth year anniversary, some of the rubble has been removed, but the people have been reshuffled. There's no housing to the level of 1.7 million people that have been built for Haitians. They have built actually more hotel rooms for foreigners, given more money to the Haitian oligarchy to become bigger billionaires. The Haitian oligarchy, as most of your people know, in the Caribbean, are the biggest billionaires in the Caribbean. So they have become multi-billionaires off of the contracts they get from the earthquake, the NGO invasion in Haiti. There's more NGOs in Haiti than anywhere else in the world. There was at during the height of the earthquake relief, and what they used to, the way the Haitian oligarch, the mercenary families, used to make money, of course, is to fly to their houses in Miami or London or France, and then rent their houses for $10,000 to $20,000 to the NGO people. So they're living in hotels. The NGOs and the UN peacekeepers, the type of lifestyle they get to live, the old Dixie plantation lifestyle with poor people and Haitians serving them hand in foot, they could not have in their own countries.
Ms. Danto, you mentioned $10 billion. Was that $10 billion collected or was just pledged by the international community?
It was collected.
It was actually collected. Now, here it is. You mentioned a while ago that there are individuals who are currently going into Haiti and purchasing the land in Haiti. How effective is the current president, Michel Martelly?
I'm sorry, how effective is he to doing what?
How is he effective, his ruling or his running Haiti right now? His effectiveness, is it questionable?
Well, yes. Michel Martelly was put into office by the United States during a time when Haiti was, had suffered an earthquake. So we had the earthquake in January 10th, 2010. He went into election mode a couple of months later when Haitians were just trying to find out who had died in their families. When they had when there was mass graves of 70,000 people buried in one time. Imagine having that in your country. Coming, let's say, from the rural area, walking to the city, looking for your loved ones. And then the United States is telling you the most important thing for you to do is go to elections. And on top of that, at the time that he was supposedly elected, the UN Nepalese soldiers had brought in the most virulent bacteria ever into the Western Hemisphere, cholera. So we had the earthquake in January 2010. There were almost 2 million people that were made homeless, billions of dollars of property damage, and 310,000 people dead in 33 seconds, over 500,000 people injured. But yet, months later, the United States is forcing Haitians with no voting cards to go to elections. So they choose who they want. More dead people voted than people who were alive because they just chose, and the OAS and the CARICOM and all these people allow it to happen. So that's what we have, and this is who this person is. So obviously his only purpose is to serve the masters who put him in power. And so far, this is what he's done. He has, according to the Haitian Constitution, you're supposed to have a parliament, right? So when he came into power, a third of the parliamentary senators and so forth, yeah, were due to have elections. So that was 3 years ago. There's not been any election for parliament, for judges, for any, no election since he came into office. He is ruling by decree. And so this is that's not a definition of dictatorship.
Absolutely.
But no one in the international community seems to be concerned. Of course, if it was a duly elected democratic popular president like President Aristide, they would be having babies when talking about, you know, dictatorship.
If you've just joined us, you're tuned into Caribbean Forum with me, Ron Bob Semple, here on the Uhuru Radio Network. My very special guest is Azili Danto, who has worked for over 10 years as an entertainment attorney within the hip-hop and R&B music circles, recording and independent film industries. If you'd like to join us in discourse, you can call us. If you're calling within the United States, you can give us a call at area code 727-565-1599. That's 727-565-1599. Or you can reach us using Skype. Our Skype ID is Uhuru Radio, U-H-U-R-U Radio. Ms. Danto, Marcus Messiah Garvey asked the question, where are our governments? Where are our men of great affairs? In a recent conversation we had, you asked the question, where are our Duty Boukman and Henri Christophe? Where are they?
That was my question. Where are they? I wish we knew. I wish we knew. With all that's happening in Haiti, I could say there's only one man in the Caribbean who has sort of stayed with us, no matter how unpopular that is, and that's the prime minister over there in St. Vincent. But essentially, yes, gosh, the name just went out of my
head.
You know who I'm talking about. Gonzalez, yes. Other than that, you know, I don't know. We have, for instance, the UN mercenaries hired guns for the U.S. and the European powers. And you have a black woman, Sandra Hoyhoe, out of Trinidad and Tobago, who is the spokesperson for Ban Ki-moon, the UN secretary. So you have, and you have CARICOM, OAS, for instance, sanctioned these mock elections when Haitians were on the street saying this is fraudulent. And the Caribbean, the CARICOM, I have no idea where Boukman is. I don't know. To tell you the truth, as a human rights activist, there was one man, and he's dead now, but he was a great journalist out of Jamaica, John Maxwell, peace to his soul. Respect to his name and honor always.
Yes.
He was our Boukman. And when he was dead, I mean, when he passed away, you know, there was no one that really took his space with regards to at least as, using his skills as a journalist to tell the world what was going on in Haiti. I don't know. I think we are in the era of the assimilated Negro. And it's at the height. Like, history is written after we have won, after you humans have won against the psychopaths who are committing all sorts of unspeakable crimes with regards to their economic enslavement policies, the unfair trade policies that make, you know, food a weapon, dumping food and destroying local agriculture and killing people off with various things like regime change and so forth. You know, this era would be seen, I think, as an era where the school blacks had definitely been schooled by their masters and served their masters. And so that's the era that I see. We're definitely uphill. We are called all kinds of derogatory names, you know, anti-American, so forth, because we stand for, some humane policy for a country that doesn't have an army, that is not a threat to anyone. The amount of force the United States has used against Haiti, and of course, you know, on another parallel level, the Caribbean is also is colonized, except that, you know, like great civil rights American said, you know, I would have saved, you know, Harriet Tubman. I would have saved more enslaved if they knew they were slaves.
Absolutely.
So these Negroes do not know they're being enslaved. They actually believe that being on the grid and you know, drinking tea with a little pinky finger and standing up for the queen is normal.
Well, I've often said that Caribbean nationals are as fragmented as the Caribbean is geographically. We'll take a short break and we'll return with my very special guest, Izili Danta.
On November 15th and 16th, Burning Spear Media will hold our annual fundraising radiothon. We are the Burning Spear newspaper, the longest-running African revolutionary journal in continuous publication since the 1960s. We are Uhuru News, the online voice of the International African Revolution. We are Uhuru Radio, bringing you news, music, analysis, and information every week to every corner of the African world.
Your world.
We are your media, telling the truth about your world. The truth you won't get from your local newspaper, the New York Times, the BBC, CNN, or Fox News. We need your support to survive and grow. You don't have to pledge to white agenda media networks that make empty promises to represent your interests. Burning Spear Media is by and for African people, talking about our reality.
Our reality.
Our condition.
Our conditions.
And our goals for freedom.
Freedom.
And liberation.
Liberation.
Tune in November 15th and 16th for our two-day radiothon, a live online radio and video broadcast with 20 hours of special guests, music, and reports from our community. Liberate your media with your dollars. Tell your friends. Organize a viewing party. Spread the word. Africa is on the rise and the future is black.
Hey, Aisha, hold on. I'll walk with you. You know, this is going to be a great class.
I know. Yeah, I'm still trying to figure out how I can exactly use these skills.
The Uhuru Movement.
The Uhuru Movement?
Yes, the Uhuru Movement. They offer great opportunities to utilize these type of skills in the most meaningful ways. I mean, writers, photography, graphic design, journalism, videography, video editing, even radio broadcasting.
Wow, sounds great. I'm assuming you have to be pretty advanced.
Not at all. I mean, although experienced is welcome, it's not mandatory. You know, the Uhuru Movement, they will train you. Log on and sign up today at uhurunews.com, where your skills are wanted and needed. Whether reporting on local news, writing for an international newspaper, or hosting your own radio show, the Uhuru Movement is the place for you. Do you have a desire to work in sales, marketing, or administration? Do you have the talent for audio engineering? Log on and sign up today, uhurunews.com. Not just explaining the world, but changing the world.
Thank you, brother. I will definitely follow up today.
And hopefully you'll become a member like I am.
Country not so long ago.
Haiti. Haiti will rise again, bringing us back here on Caribbean Forum. I'm Ron Wolf, 7 with 3. We're here Saturday mornings from 9 until 11 a.m. Eastern Time, where we examine issues that affect Caribbean nationals at home and across the diaspora. My special guest this morning is Zili Danto. And we're chatting about the status of Haiti and other involvements of Ms. Danto. Ms. Danto, you are the founder and president of the Haitian Lawyers Leadership Network. Tell us about the mission of your organization.
The Haitian Lawyers Leadership founded in 1994 when I was actually asked by the first democratically elected president, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, to if there were any other Haitian lawyers that were like me out here. I met him when he was in exile in the United States during the first coup d'etat. And so we put together the Haitian Lawyers Leadership Network back then. The function, the mission, is to dedicate to institutionalizing the rule of law and human rights in Haiti, and to protect and defend the civil, cultural, and economic rights of Haitians living at home and abroad.
Your organization is the leading international and Haitian voice against right-wing humanitarian imperialism, pushing the neoliberal quote-unquote death plan and disaster capitalism in Haiti, and their corresponding leftist paid-to-lose tenured progressives. What challenges the group has faced in this regard?
Every possible overwhelming odd, we have faced it. When I first started the Haitian Lawyers Leadership Network, it was supposed to be something to provide a defense bar for the Haitian government at the time. As lawyers, I can tell you for the last 20 years, because it was founded in 1994, we are now in 2014. So it's been 20 years straight, and I had absolutely no intention, actually, of heading a legal organization. I was a lawyer that was doing corporate finance and entertainment law at the time, as well as my artistic work. So the challenges are many, of course, because we are a group of people trying to bring law into a nation where the United States constantly brings impunity of the wealthy. What can I tell you? Okay, name it, and I've dealt with it. I can. You come in with this idea of law. I came in with the idea, along with 250. When we started out in 1994, President Aristide had asked me, how many, Haitian American lawyers are there in America, and can we get them together to come and volunteer to put together a defense bar to assist with the coup d'etat victims? And so that's how it started for me. But when I got to Haiti in 1994, the United States Agency for International Development under Clinton, Bill Clinton, okay, who is now, of course, the bane of our existence again in 2014 as the sort of colonial governor of Haiti. But back then, he was returning Aristide into power, and part of that reason was it was the end of the Cold War. People, they couldn't really hunt with that excuse for the United States to put together to keep dictatorship, because of communism was like a great evil. So they were in that process, and in that time, the United States and the colonists, the enslaving countries, were recreating the paradigm for the new slavery we have now, the new colonialism we have now. So it wasn't, communism wasn't the great evil. They were trying to figure out what it's going to be. And it was at one point, terrorism.
Right.
Well, there's no terrorism in Haiti. So they had to come up with some sort of a way to be in Haiti, and now it's called the NGOs. We are the nation of NGOs. So the United States and the Europeans play the role of both villain and hero. So in Haiti, they are the villain who took down the democratically elected government. They are the hero who are bringing us peacekeepers to stabilize us. They fund both sides. They fund the anti-democratic Duvalierists, and then they fund the UN, who is there actually, literally, to keep the people from participating in their government and from a democratically elected system. So, essentially, the Haitian lawyers' leadership has had to face that whole paradigm. I have a piece out called "The Quiet Genocide in Haiti," from the FDR to Obama, and the UN, a criminal organization, from Lumumba, because they were complicit in Patrice Lumumba's death back in the 1960s, doing the first sort of decolonization attempts of Africa, to Aristide, which they helped the Colin Powell, Condi Rice, and the Bush administration back in 2004 have a cover for their invasion of Haiti by giving it a name that it's the interim military force. So the Marines came in, put President Aristide in a plane and deported him back to Africa, and then the UN helped to legitimize that. So as a organization of lawyers, activists, artists, you know, I had to, at certain points, once I realized what the paradigm was, we opened up the Haitian lawyers' leadership, because I realized that I couldn't go to court, since the judges were people put in to maintain dictatorship. So, and I also realized one of the reasons that this is possible is that the racism allows for the rest of the world to believe that Haitians are basically cannibals and violent people, when we are less violent than the Dominican Republic, less violent than Jamaica, less violent than most of the nations in the Caribbean. And this is according to UN statistics and international statistics. So why do we have a UN Chapter 7 peace enforcement agreement, a peace enforcement mission in Haiti, when there is no peace to it, no warring parties or peace agreement to enforce? Because the United States wants to take over Haiti. So our work has been hard, because so today I am known as the woman who writes the non-colonial narrative on Haiti, because I couldn't practice my craft as a lawyer in a situation when the might makes right.
Yeah.
And you can have a constitution, you can have laws, but then the United States, the greatest power, the most supposedly the richest people, most educated people in the world, are coming in to give you a double standard. And nobody seems to question the fact that you're in a country where, you know, supposedly one man, one vote, one person, one vote. But the United States could come in and do selections, could ignore the Constitution, ignore the law. So I think that we have had to face, so that's why I write the non-colonial narrative in Haiti, because I think one of the most important things is for people to understand the truth about who and what the United States is about what Haiti is about, and the fact that we are a people of the greatest strugglers, and we have been battling extinction since 1806, since they killed Jean-Jacques Dessalines. So we're still here because we are warriors. We're still here because we fight, and the Haitian lawyers' leadership is one of the tools of that fight. We run also the Free Haiti Movement. Also, I have Zini Blo, which is clean water, skills transfer, and solar power for Haiti. So we bring in the solution to help ourselves, while, you know, all this money is being bounded about by the Clintons. Actually, in Washington, they call the Haiti Reconstruction Fund the Bill and Hillary Fund.
Wow. Speaking of the 1800s, Ms. Danto, the Haitian Revolution, which is from 1791 to 1804, was a slave revolt in the French colony of Saint-Domingue, which culminated in the elimination of slavery there and the founding of the Republic of Haiti. Now, the Haitian Revolution was the only slave revolt that led to the founding of a state. In our next segment, we'll be chatting with our filmmaker, Karen Mafundingwa, whose documentary, The Price of Memory, explores the decades-long movement for reparations. With the ending of slavery in Haiti some 210 years ago, what's your take on reparations for Africans?
It's something, it's like trying to be whole again. When you have had, in Haiti, for instance, we've had 300 years of enslavement. We were the first Africans brought to this Western Hemisphere in chains.
Mm-hmm.
So the Holocaust started with Haiti. 1503, we came, my grand-grands were brought to the islands of Haiti, named by the Tainos, who were destroyed.
That's correct.
On that island. So 300 years of enslavement, where the most brutal, the most imaginable treatment, women were breeded like mares, there were farms for sexual, for creating people, and separating families and so forth, you know. So we're talking about how do you bring wholeness to that? And then the Africans who became Haitians in the land of the Tainos in 1794, what's unique about those Africans is that they went back to Mother Africa. They went back inside themselves. And Bookman, who came out of Jamaica, Christophe, who came out of, but another Caribbean island. So it was an effort of Africans. Culminations of various Maroon movements. And after 13 years of war, we beat the French, the Spanish, and the British, the greatest powers on earth at that time, in combat to create Haiti. But we have had 200 years of containment and poverty.
Excellent.
Containment is what it's about. So for Haiti, it's a unique case. With regards to reparation, because when we won our independence, the Europeans came back and said, you know, the only way we're going to recognize you as a power, as a nation, is if you pay us back.
That's right.
For every slave that we lost for the whole island, if you pay us. So Haitians have paid in blood for 300 years, in labor for 300 years, and then they asked Haitians to pay after they won in combat, to pay for the loss of my grand-grand as property to France and to all the mercenaries in America who had moved to Louisiana. So we paid and paid and paid. Haiti paid, according to President Aristide, one of the other reasons why they took him down in 2004, he asked France back for the independence debt that we had to pay. We paid for, it was $22 billion he paid in payment. But in terms of those dollars back in, let's say, 1804, the Louisiana Purchase, which is the land that Napoleon sold to Jefferson, was sold for $150 million. That's the amount that they put for, as the independence debt that Haitians had to pay for a space that was no bigger than Rhode Island. Okay, so Rhode Island and the Louisiana Purchase is a territory that became 13 American states. So we had to pay and for what conceivably would be for 13 American states, because it was $150 million that Jefferson paid to Napoleon for the Louisiana Purchase, only made possible because the warriors in Haiti had taken out of France and it couldn't hold its position in Louisiana, in the Louisiana territory. So the United States doubled its size because of the work of my ancestors.
We are just about, Ms. Danto, we're just about running out of time, and I knew this would have happened, and which means that that we'll have to have you back on Caribbean Forum. Before I let you go, how can one get in contact with you, please?
EzilyDantol.com. Go to our website, EZILIDANTO. Go to our Facebook page. I have a piece called The Quiet Genocide in Haiti. You can come and join the Free Haiti movement. We are the voices that are out here trying to defend 10 million Haitians without a voice whose properties are being taken. But we fight on, and we hope that there is Bookman out there in the Caribbean somewhere.
Ms. Danto, merci. Merci beaucoup.
Thank you.
Bonsoir, madame.
Take care. Bye-bye.
We've been listening to Ezili Danto here on Caribbean Forum.
You're listening to WhoRadio.com, voice of the International African Revolution.
It's now time to order Omali Ishitela's new book, The Uneasy Equilibrium, The African Revolution versus Parasitic Capitalism. Chairman Omali's groundbreaking political analysis shows the way forward for people looking for answers during this period of crisis for imperialism, a crisis that offers great opportunity for colonized peoples everywhere. This latest book by the founder and leader of the African Socialist International and the Uhuru Movement costs $29.99. Order now at burningspearmarketplace.com or by calling 727-824-5700. Call 727-824-5700 or visit burningspearmarketplace.com today. Uhuru means freedom.
You're listening to Caribbean Forum with Ron Bob Sample, the voice of reason. You're listening to Caribbean Forum with Ron Bob Sample.
This is Caribbean Forum with Ron Bob Sample, the voice of reason.
In Jamaica, we live with reminders of slavery scattered across the island, and the legacy of slavery runs deep, touching the fabric of our lives.
It is a very special pleasure for me, on the occasion of my Golden Jubilee, to address the Jamaican Parliament.
Most people, when they see these beautiful buildings, they always ask, when were they built? The correct question to ask is, where did the money come from to build these buildings?
We build the British Empire with blood, sweat and tears. We should get redress to reparation now.
I do not think that it is remotely realistic to start talking of reparations at this stage. Reparations breed envy. They breed distrust. They stir up hatred.
The case for reparations for slavery rests on the premise that the effects of slavery are still being felt by Africans now living in Africa and the diaspora. There is no evidence of this.
The money went to Britain. The memories remained here.
Well, welcome back to Caribbean Forum. I'm Ron Bob Semple with you here on the Uhuru Radio Network, Saturday mornings, live from 9 until 11 a.m. Eastern Time, and then we are rebroadcast during the week. You can always check our schedule at uhurunews.com or uhururadio.com. Well, film captures spontaneity forever. You just listened to the trailer from the latest project of my next guest, who has embarked on this project entitled The Price of Memory, Karen Mafundikwa, welcome to Caribbean Forum and to the Uhuru Radio Network.
Thank you so much. Good morning to everyone. Good morning to all your listeners. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Sister Karen, have you always wanted to be a filmmaker? What fascinated you about this medium?
From I was very small, I always wanted to work in media. I imagined myself working in television. I didn't know in what capacity. I was a television addict growing up. My brother and I would sit and watch TV and decide what should have been the ending and so how things should have worked out, or, oh, there's another way we could have done it. So, yeah, we were just talking about that last week, that I've always been interested in media, and I studied journalism, and I thought that would have been it, you know, working in television, but I found television a bit just, restricting. The short format.
Right.
So I realized that my great love was documentary, and that's how I ended up in documentary film.
Your documentary explores the enduring legacy of slavery in Jamaica and the decades-long movement for reparations. Why the title, The Price of Memory?
Okay. The title came to me after some time. I realized that we were talking about memory, you know, our collective memory, my family memories, the memories of the people who are in the film and whose lives unfold in the film. And then also everyone was paying a huge price for it. And that, so it was on multiple levels that people in the film were paying a huge price to pursue reparations, personal price. I was paying a personal price. And then also that there was a cost involved, you know, in memory then. So then I realized, oh, this is really about the cost of memory, the price of memory. What would be the cost? And really it could never be paid for us to, you know, reconcile our memories. So that's how I came to that title.
This project has been a labor of love for you, hasn't it?
Yes. It's been a real it took me more than a decade to make. I started it in 2002 and I really finished it at the end of 2013.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, editing took a long time, and while I was editing I shot more. So, yeah, it was really a decade, and I never thought it would have taken me that long, but then I realized how complicated it was, and the scope of what I wanted to do, took years, really. I mean, it took me years sometimes to find various people who, for example, I explored the mission to Africa in the 1960s with Rastafari, who wanted to repatriate, and the three people who went on the mission, the second mission, who lived with Haile Selassie in the palace and all of that. That took me years to find all three, to get all three to interview, and just years to follow the lives. So, of course, something like that, you don't do because you do it because you love it. And there were times when everybody thought, you want to do something else? I mean, fast the money, etc. But it was something I really, really was obsessed with for a long time, and I'm very happy I did it.
You mentioned it took you about a decade to complete, and I'm almost positive that it was not smooth sailing all along. What are some of the obstacles that you were faced with and the challenges making this documentary?
Well, initially when I started, I was working in television in New York. And what happened was I was working in television in New York, and I read an article somewhere that Queen Elizabeth was coming to Jamaica. So I now live in Jamaica. So she was coming to Jamaica to celebrate her jubilee, you know, her golden jubilee. It was 40th anniversary. And I don't want to go off on a story. So when I started, I thought it was going to be a short, right? And then it became a long film. So you can imagine the leap for me. So then I was working and I had to be taking time off to come to Jamaica to film until I realized, well, you can't, you know, you have to make a choice. And I literally decided to leave a steady paying, you know, job in TV to work on an independent documentary. So it was like jumping out of a plane, really. So challenges were clearly, you know, would have been money. I had to raise the money. The first 2 years, I just used my own money, shot on my own until I raised artist funding. But that, besides money, there, you know, money is just one part, but that's not the, that's a big part, but it's not the, the major part is really, I did all the research myself. So just the research, which really a lot of it was discovery. So I enjoyed it, but it was still a lot of work. And I'd be doing that and doing a temporary job or freelancing, finding the archival footage because, I mean, I started when the internet wasn't as widespread. So yes. Now you can just go to, say, the Library of Congress and look for the images and you can see all the images there and download them. But then everything was more, it was slower. And then also just building the relationships with time. But once you have the relationship and someone understands that you're going to portray them with dignity, you're going to be fair, everything became simpler and easier. People would call you and tell you what's happening. So it's just, you know, and just the challenges of between Jamaica to the U.S. Sometimes things happen slower and people would make an appointment. And, you know, I mean, they're not in the film, but just people who you would want to interview to get information understand academics. And they're, oh, okay, they have something else to do because you're not the BBC or somebody very important. So, you know, that kind of thing. It was just getting, people didn't really, I wasn't some legendary person. So just, you know, building understanding and the relationship, that takes time. And once you have time, people told you things you would never have gone if you just came in for a couple of weeks and left.
In the film, you say, we can't go back to who we could have been before slavery. We must evolve. What do you mean by that?
Well, that part of the film, because you're talking about the end, was written very late at night, and it was a lot to write that part. That line, I was saying that, okay, so, for example, when I go back to Africa, I'm not going back to the Africa we left. Because Africa also, you know, it's modern Africa. It's not Africa the 18th century or when we left, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I think we also have to look at the contemporary challenges that we face as a people, you know, African diaspora people and African people. So that's what I meant, that what are our challenges now? Who are we now? You know, how have we evolved? Are we looking still at it? And of course, there are the values and the spiritual legacies of that period of Africa that we want to keep, but we also have to look at where we are presently and what are we fighting for.
So
we talk about reparations, for example, you know, what are the development issues we're looking at? So I don't know. I hope that clarifies what I meant.
Speaking of reparations, what are some of the things that you learned while... Mm-hmm. putting this film together as far as the reparations is concerned?
Yeah. One thing that really intrigued me because I didn't know was that in the 1860s, former slaves in Jamaica, because in the British Caribbean, as you may know, you know, freedom came in the 1830s, right? Let's say the end of slavery because it wasn't really freedom. And so my group had wrote to Queen Victoria asking for social relief and land. And she said, work harder and then the planters will pay you more money. I mean, that was the first reparations request. I didn't know that there was a documented, you know, going all the way back that really from soon after slavery, people had started to seek reparations. So that was very interesting to me. And then you had someone who is not in the film because I couldn't find any image or anything to talk about him, but his name again, Theophilus Scholes, who was a Jamaican doctor and scholar, and he also had advocated for reparations around 1900. So, I mean, it's an old movement. It's not something that's just happening now in the Caribbean or in the U.S. And then, just all the various, you know, following the I went to the UK and I looked at the legacy there, just all the institutions that came out of slavery. I mean, it wasn't just a few wealthy people in Europe or in the US, but in Britain, for example, which I focus on, the benefits to Britain were just widespread. The Bank of England came from slavery. in huge insurance companies, institutions, universities, that became industrialized, even the money, the compensation money, for example. Okay, when slavery ended, the slaves were not compensated in the British Caribbean. However, the planters, the owners, were compensated. And that was mind-boggling to me. I didn't learn that in high school. I can't remember learning that anywhere besides when I started researching. So £20 million were paid, which should have been, I don't know, a trillion or whatever today. And that money went into all kinds of, that was 40% of their annual budget at the time. That must show you how, you know, what a big decision it was to pay these people the money. Mm-hmm, 40% mm-hmm. of their budget is what they spent. So all of that was very, I don't know, I've always loved history. So it was very interesting to me because I was learning things that nobody would, you know, I had to go out and learn these things. So I've tried to make it tell it in an interesting way and honest way. And I hope, you know, others will see that.
This was mentioned briefly in the documentary. Mm-hmm. There has been a preponderance of skin bleaching there in Jamaica, where you are right now, and other parts mm-hmm. of the Caribbean. Where did mm-hmm. that come from?
Well, it's complicated because it's funny because I don't know where, when I was growing up, I don't remember people really bleaching to this extent. Like, just everywhere you look, you see visibly that someone has bleached. But I know that, you know, in Jamaica, certainly, there's always been this kind of color, what should I say, hierarchy. So, you know, I suppose in post, in my generation, I don't know, it's probably better than I would say in my parents' generation, but it's certainly still there where the assumption, there's an assumption of privilege, if you're lighter, and of not just an assumption, but a real, you really do, may have more access, you know, and privilege. So I think it's part of that where people are claiming that, okay, let me lighten my skin and I will have that privilege or I will look more beautiful because, you know, there's certainly a lot of issues that we still have around color. And it comes from really slavery because during enslavement, as all of us know, you know, privilege was given to lighter skin where there were light-skinned people before in Africa and wherever, but it was never a privilege or a hierarchy around color.
Mm.
But the whole slavery system created this hierarchy, you know, from the rape of slaves and
you know, I've had Dr. Carlin Cooper from the University mm-hmm. of West Indies, a professor there, here on the broadcast. Mm-hmm. And we were talking about this. And I think when mm-hmm. we were talking, there was a documentary that was being shown there in Jamaica regarding mm-hmm. this. And I did have an opportunity to view it. Mm-hmm. Is it still prevalent?
Oh, is it still pertinent, the bleaching?
Yes. Is it still prevalent?
Oh, my goodness. It is. Yes, it is, unfortunately. You know, and what you see some young men, teenagers, but it's usually more working youth, you know, youth from the inner city. And it's really sad to see, like, that's the only way they think they can empower themselves. You see people cover in the hot, hot sun, you see people with their sleeves long, with long sleeves and really hot clothes, and this is just to keep the sun out. And they might have a hat on. They're always covering themselves, and it's really sad to see.
You know, I've heard lyrics by some Jamaican artists that include the word referring to my brownin.
Mm-hmm.
But when
mm-hmm.
I heard that, I had never associated it with what I heard subsequently, that this bleaching, mm-hmm. they're also mm-hmm. referred to as a browning. I'm telling you, it's just absolutely mind-boggling. If you've just joined us, we're chatting with Karen Mafandikwa, mm-hmm. The director and the writer and the producer of a new documentary, The Price of Memory. Mm-hmm. Sister Karen, what are some of the invisible scars that slavery has left on us?
Okay. One, I would say a major one in Jamaica is still the hierarchy or just issues around skin color, where we still believe that lighter is more beautiful, and not just that, but then because of the whole self-esteem issues, just having more access to lighter skin. That's one, and that's major. Yeah, I mean, I have a friend who's very dark, and I'm lighter, and it's so funny because we'll talk about, you know, our experiences here, having lived abroad and coming back, and see, it's just a stark experience how everything is so color-coded, you know, but people never say these things. You don't say it polite. So color, I think it's major. But beyond that, you look at the visible landscape in Jamaica. There are ruins all over. And I start the film with that, showing how one place really scared me as a child.
Yes.
And I came to realize that slaves had been hanged there for rebellion. So you have the visible. And so I feel that even just seeing it affects the psyche, because we know, you know, you can see, you know, the slavery walls, the ones that were built by slaves, the buildings that are all over the place, the plantations. So Jamaica is a former plantation society. And then our diet was, you know, the diet that was everything about our lives. The diet that we eat was largely a slave-legislated diet. I mean, we eat saltfish that came from Newfoundland. It was a part of the whole economy of slavery. Then if we look at the family structure, you know, this is not the family structure we had in Africa.
Mm.
Then I would say, though, I don't know if I should say it's coming just from slavery, but we'll pride ourselves on being rebellious people. You know, we had 22 rebellions in Jamaica and one that ended pretty much, you know, after all that. Well, the British were losing money anyway, they decided to end slavery. So, I mean, when you look at the economy then, following slavery, we were just let loose. We didn't get reparations, we didn't get anything to develop the country. And look at post-independence Jamaica. When independence came, we were given £1 million and a piece of land that the British had owned, the gate passed, signed it over to us. And so what really, you know, soon after we ended up under these IMFs and various international agency programs, and Jamaica's economy today, we're deeply in debt. The country we've inherited, we can't look at it without examining the whole legacy of slavery. The economy, our family life, I mean, yes, you know, of course, there are things we ourselves can do. There are certainly people who have, you know, developed a lot of family structures, but we still have a large number of female-headed households and, color issues and all of that comes from slavery. I mean, it's not, I'm saying that I've spent a lot of time reading about it, and I see it clearly.
Well, Sister Karen, I must congratulate you on the completion of this documentary, The Price of Memory, and I know you have some upcoming engagements as far as the film being viewed. And we'll talk again, and more than likely have you back on the broadcast as those times draw near.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you very much, Sister Karen Mafundikwa. She's the director, the producer, the writer of the documentary film, The Price of Memory. Well, also,
can I just say it's on Facebook? You can look at the Facebook page.
Yes. How can one contact you?
Okay, so a lot of information about the film is on Facebook at The Price of Memory, the same name of the film. The trailer is online, or you can email me at thepriceofmemory@gmail.com. Thank you so much for having me.
You're very much welcome, and as I mentioned, it explores, you know, this the decade-long movement for reparations and the African People's Solidarity Committee, Chairwoman Penny Hess. They're also very, very, very forcibly and forcefully pressing for reparations for Africans. And just here is Penny Hess, the chairwoman of the African People's Solidarity Committee, talking about white reparations to African people.
Interesting.
Thank you very much.
The struggle to make honest reparations to Africans begins with coming to terms with the brutal truth of the world as created by capitalism and Western imperialism. It forces us to put aside the petty denial of reality so characteristic of a parasitic class of people who have never experienced life under the oppressive thumb of imperialism, but who have lived off that oppression. Reparations begins by acknowledging the millions of Africans who were ripped out of their land and civilization and chained body to body in the holds of ships, brought violently to labor for free on this land so that you and I could live the life that we have always been permitted to assume that we inherited. Reparations acknowledges openly the slaughter, the torture, the sheer brutality, and the act of forcibly transferring the resources and stealing the labor to benefit us. Reparations acknowledges the millions of human beings severed from language and culture, from home and family, husband and wife, mother from child, to produce the wealth for us so that our families could rest on a foundation of seemingly unassailable security. Reparations looks honestly at the abandoned mines, the volcano craters, the vast mass graves found in Africa, throughout the Americas, and in most of the colonies, which are filled with forever nameless bodies whose flesh had been burned, whose fingers were chopped off, whose legs were broken, whose frames lay twisted, and whose skulls are pierced with bullet holes, silenced so that we could experience a mellow and harmonious lifestyle. Reparations acknowledges the babies never born, the babies born and died, the babies ripped from their mother's wombs, the children who should carry the genius and strength of the people with bellies extended in hunger, clinging to mothers whose starving bodies can produce no milk, so that our children can grow up strong, healthy, arrogant, and hardened to the call of humanity. Reparations acknowledges African culture, so rich, so vibrant, so deep in its humanity and beauty, so irrepressible that the oppressor was never capable of beating it out of the people and ended up trying to steal it, claiming it as part of the loot. It acknowledges the fact that our grandparents originated the county fair around the lynching of African men and women whose tormented and lifeless bodies hung from trees as the centerpiece of North American entertainment. The fact that we are still lynching Africans and otherwise turning our backs on the hell being brought down on black workers by our government in our name, so that we might live without experiencing the ravages of colonialism at close quarters. Reparations acknowledges the ghettos, the barrios, the prisons, the police, the educational institutions, the joblessness, the poverty, and the enforced influx of deadly, devastating drugs designed to break the spirit and crush the dreams of African and colonized youth so that our youth can know unlimited possibilities for the future. Reparations acknowledges the Africans, the Palestinians, the Mexican, Guatemalan, and Arab people, and millions of others being tortured in dark cells right this minute, whose struggle against our government is prolonged, who must carry double the load because we have not taken up our responsibility inside this country, the belly of the beast. Reparations are not charity. It lets white people acknowledge that, yes, life on the tortured back of humanity is intolerable, and that existence as parasites sucking the blood of the peoples of the world is unendurable. That ours is a culture so violent and so barren that the denial of the reality of colonialism is the only currency for existence. that in the culture of imperialism, the pursuit of mindless and obligatory happiness must be purchased with drugs, alcohol, consumerism, conformity, and meaningless pleasure to mask the terrible pain of reality which inevitably rises to the surface of our beings. Reparations acknowledges that the culture of imperialism, alienated from the mass of humanity, has made it so that the most simple relations between human beings are twisted after the model of imperialism itself, and love, like women's bodies, is a billion-dollar commodity in the marketing of denial. The struggle for white people's reparations to African people acknowledges the inevitable course of history, in which those who have suffered and suffocated as the cornerstone of this corrupt system must turn the gun on U.S. imperialism, not to perpetrate violence, but to end it. And that if we are ever to stand shoulder to shoulder with African people and the peoples of the world in an honest way, we must carry on our shoulders the weight of an inherited past and present, the children of the slave masters facing the children of the enslaved. In this process, we recognize the fundamental reality that our long, violent, parasitic, but intimate relationship with African people underlines the truth that Africans created the foundation on which our stolen house rests, and that any struggle against U.S. imperialism is necessarily bound to the leadership of African workers in the struggle for independence and socialism. Reparations recognizes that revolution is not waged on empty words and ideals, but in the real seizure of political power, resources, and means of production as the basis of black power to the African community. And that North American people can unite with our genuine interest in the destruction of the system by building a movement to destroy the resource and power base of U.S. imperialism from our front, where those resources have been hoarded, and by taking responsibility for the transfer of resources to the African Revolution. The struggle for reparations lets us express the deepest meaning of human solidarity with African people and the colonized of the earth, a shared bond based on seeing the world through their eyes and uniting with their interests, aspirations, and goals for a new world and the final destruction of this vicious and deadly system of slaves and slave masters, oppressors and the oppressed. And finally, the struggle for reparations allows us as white people to overturn the corrupt me-first psychology peddled by imperialism and bought by a white population identified with our own ruling class. The struggle for white people's reparations to African people is indeed a new beginning for us, opening up the possibility for becoming new communist human beings for whom the suffering of any child under colonialism is as painful as the suffering of our own child, where our interests are one with the interest of colonized workers for whom there is no rest until African independence is achieved, U.S. imperialism is destroyed, and power is in the hands of the people. Build the movement for white people's reparations to African people. All power to the people, black power to the African community. Uhuru.
That was Penny Hess, a chairwoman of the African People's Solidarity Committee here on Caribbean Forum.
There are more U.S. reporters covering the New York Yankees.
Oh, Karen, are you still there?
Than there are covering the entire continent of Africa.
Sister Karen, are you still there?
It's a shame when we as African people, we make up damn near the majority of the city, but we have to fight to get on white ruling class media.
That tells you something about the priorities of the news media in this country.
We are engaged in a war of ideas.
Warning.
You're locked in to Uhuru Radio.
Stand by.
Right here, right now.
APSP, UhuruRadio.com.
I and I no mix with the wicked men. I and I set trampled it.
Sankalaba. 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 Sankalaba.
Uhuru Radio was envisioned as a means by which our community, our people, our party, our revolutionary aspirations could contend with the ruling class in this war of ideas that contributes to maintaining the oppression of African people. Part of what African internationalism, Garveyism in the 21st century is about is ending that isolation, is bringing African people together in common struggle. And Uhuru Radio, it allows Africans in any place in the world to have access to other Africans so that reinforcements are always on the way, no matter where it is that we're struggling and no matter what may be the temporary setbacks.
Finally, the station you've been looking for.
Uhuru Radio. No degrading lyrics.
I never call you my boo. There's so much in the name and so much more in you.
Progressive.
And you love her like you are. So you buy her a diamond. If I want to die, oh, don't you think there's something wrong with it?
Informative.
And millions of dollars leave Sierra Leone in the form of diamonds, yet the people who mine the diamonds make 30 cents a day and a cup of rice. That's the reality all over Africa.
And revolutionary.
AFDEF is an organization of the Uhuru movement that was built in 2007 in order to organize African doctors, nurses, scientists, engineers, and other skilled Africans around the world to coordinate a variety of development projects that work to transform the miserable conditions of existence that have been imposed on our people around
APST,
Uhuru Radio.com. Uhuru Radio is developing a new programming schedule to include more music, cultural, educational, political, and multilingual programs from around the world. We are professionalizing the technical delivery of our programming, improving our sound quality and presentation. We're working to make our audio stream more accessible through mobile devices and distribution networks. This is your media, Uhuru News, Uhuru Radio, and the Burning Spear newspaper, the voice of the International African Revolution. We rely on your support to get the truth out about our struggle for freedom. Become a member today. Your donation of any amount will make a difference.
APSP, UhuruRadio.com. APSP, UhuruRadio.com.
Information, ideas, reality. That's what the Burning Spear newspaper offers you each month. Truth about government, society, entertainment, and the world around you. The Burning Spear is the oldest Black Power newspaper in existence, and your one-year subscription is only $25. Get the insight and perspective that the mass media machine cannot and will not deliver. Read dynamic articles on the most pressing issues affecting the lives of African workers in the U.S., Africa, and around the world. Each month, you'll find real political analysis of the crisis of parasitic capitalism, insight into world and local events, and a focus on the realities and struggles in the heart of the hood, expressing the vision and voice of the African working class. Uncompromising truth, unwavering focus, the Burning Spear newspaper. This is Black Power in the 21st century. Subscribe today and don't get fooled again. Order your subscription now. Go to BurningSpearMarketplace.com and click on Spear. That's BurningSpearMarketplace.com and click on Spear. Uhuru.
Hi. I received a few messages and some of them stated that I didn't understand the problems and I didn't understand why people commit suicide. You're right. Some of the problems I do not understand. But these are the problems I do understand. I understand homelessness. I understand the fact that you may not have enough to eat. I understand the cost of education. I understand the fact that sometimes you're in a disastrous relationship and you don't know how to get out of it. I understand fear. I understand them because I've experienced them. But what I know for a fact is that you have to give yourself a chance. Suicide is never, never the answer to any of these problems. It is a permanent solution. But what you have done is you've created another problem if you have children left behind, family members who will have questions that can never be answered. There will be a hole that it cannot fill. They will be angry for a while. They will be grieving. They will be confused. They will be overwhelmed. They will hear a lot of crap from other people. They will even hear some condemnation that, oh, you're going to hell because you killed yourself. These are the issues that are going to be left behind. So before you commit suicide, think hard. Find somebody. Trust somebody. Talk to somebody. I know these are the hard things to do when you're in despair, but you have got to give yourself a chance. Please think about it. I can't make anybody do anything they don't want to do. But what I can ask you is to give yourself a chance and do hope for the best for the future. Suicide will never be the answer. Please, please, please. Think hard before you commit this act. Think.
Well, welcome back to Caribbean Forum. I'm Ron Bobsample with you here on the Uhuru Radio Network, Saturday mornings, live 9 until 11 a.m. Eastern Time, and then we will rebroadcast during the week here on the network. Well, we've been addressing the escalation of domestic violence in the Caribbean here on Caribbean Forum. There's also been a vast increase in the suicidal rate in Guyana. And joining us from New York City are representatives of the Center for Social Justice and Development, Ismay Griffith, Derek R. June, and Tony Jones. Sister and brothers, welcome. Good morning. Welcome to Caribbean Forum and to the Uhuru Radio Network.
Good morning.
Good morning, Ron.
Is Tony also with us?
Yes, good morning,
yes,
Ron.
Yes, good morning.
Fine.
Thank you for joining us this morning. Ms. Ismay, could you give us a brief history and the structure of the organization? Ms. Griffith, are you still there with us?
Yes, I'm hearing you.
Yes, your line is breaking up a little. I was asking
okay, let me see if I can join in while her line gets straightened up.
Great. Thank you very much, Tony.
The conceptualization of the center was really as far back as 2009, when a few concerned citizens in the continental USA got together on teleconference to explore what we can do as members of the Guyanese national community here. We came up with the idea of having a think tank where we look at public policy as it pertains to socioeconomic and political matters affecting Guyana and how we in the diaspora can contribute. That idea did not really germinate. So back in 2010, we organized a forum which allowed us to have a better view of what role an organization can play within the diaspora to alleviate some of the problems and contribute to nation building. That then morphed into the Center for Social Justice and Development, in which we had a forum earlier this year, February to be exact, in New York, which we then set up a kind of a basis for the existence of the organization. Out of that came what we have as a newsletter, monthly newsletter, which we produce, the title of which is The New Road. And it's a 10-page monthly edition, and I hope and encourage your listeners to peruse it on our website, which I'll give later in the program. So also we had discussed in February the idea of some of the social problems that Guyanese abroad and at home are facing. And we decided we will have a forum for women. We then crystallized that with the idea that both suicide and domestic problems are having major concerns. And this forum on Saturday, November the 4th, addressed.
The theme of that forum is combating the scourge of domestic violence in Guyana. Ms. Griffith, how prevalent is it in the land of my birth?
Well, if Derek would like to take that.
Ms. Griffith, please.
I am a little challenged. Good morning.
Yes.
I am a little challenged because I'm in the process of preparing for a cancer awareness forum.
Okay.
So if you're not getting me clearly, that's the reason why. To go closer to my community and made a few calls, and there we were. And it was a space that was not, you know, they're terribly expensive spaces.